It's one thing to listen to doom and gloom about food and fertilizer shortages, skyrocketing prices, the cost of living, or your job being outsourced overseas or eliminated due to automation. It's quite another thing to hear practical, immediately actionable advice from experts who can help you reduce the fear, anxiety, and burden of these problems.
Tune in now to the Surviving Hard Times podcast from the Finding Genius Foundation with Richard Jacobs. Before we begin, a note from our sponsor. I'm Richard Jacobs, Executive Director of the nonprofit Finding Genius Foundation and host of the Finding Genius podcast. In late 2016, I was rear-ended at 65 miles an hour by a truck on the highway, which sent me off-road into a ditch. The impact of the collision gave me a concussion and other injuries. At the hospital, a CT scan showed that I had thyroid nodules, which turned out to be cancer. It was then, when I had a biopsy in my neck, that I realized even if I was a millionaire, I wouldn't want a second or a third biopsy due to the pain and the invasiveness of it. And appointments at that time for thyroid experts were 3 to 6 months out, and I was worried about dying now, even if that was irrational. So because of this, I've decided to raise money to conduct a literature review on steroids, on the causes of anxiety and depression, a condition that affects well over 50 million people in the United States and hundreds of millions worldwide. Our goal is to create a codex, a guide, that reveals all possible treatments for anxiety and depression for people that live with the condition, or for loved ones that have it, as my wife and my son do. To find out more about our fundraiser, visit findinggeniusfoundation.org and click on Current Initiatives. And now, to our guest. Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Surviving Hard Times podcast, sponsored by the Finding Genius Foundation.
I have Andre Luis Becerra Ribeiro de Silva. He's an assistant professor and a vegetable extension specialist. It's part of the Department of Horticulture at Auburn University. So we're going to talk about Dr. De Silva's work. Andre, thank you for coming.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me to be here, Richard.
Yeah, if you would, tell me about the work you're doing at Auburn. What specifically are you focusing on within horticulture?
So I'm an assistant professor and an extension vegetable specialist here at the Department of Horticulture at Auburn University. My program runs in applied research on crop management practices for vegetable crops in general, and later to translate that information to growers to help them on decision-making during crop management practices. So basically, I'm focused on investigate fertilizer management, irrigation scheduling, the selection of cultivar for different vegetable crops, such as tomatoes, bell pepper, pumpkins, or squash, broccoli, cabbage, and et cetera. So, and then growers have, my goal is try to develop, help that vegetable industry to grow in the state. So we are focused not only in conventional system, but also in organic system.
Okay. So what kind of help are you providing? Like, are there certain vegetables that you're an expert in, or the method of growing, or where's your expertise?
Yeah. So It's a very good question, because most of the times we receive that question, but what is the vegetable you focus? So in Alabama, our top vegetables goes as tomatoes, watermelons, sweet potato. Last year, our state vegetable crop was sweet potato. And sweet corn is also well grown here. We have a good cucumber growers. So I'm not focused only in one vegetable, but on irrigation and fertility of most of the vegetables, because those vegetables, they are, most of the vegetables, they have a short root system, and we have mostly sandy soils in the state. What depth of water is very common, so the plants suffer with lack of water. So apply water in the right time is the type of research that I conducted. Plus, we are in the southeastern U.S., where we have a great weather variability. So there are years that it's very rainy, and there are years that we have a very poor rain. Like early this year, if you guys remember, in July this year, we had a heat stroking and a lot of drought problems. And suddenly now in August, we have a lot of rainfall going on. So
I'm in Austin, Texas, and that's exactly what happened. It was so dry, and now it rained like 10 times, and everything's super green.
Yeah, and that's driving crazy, because they need to plan their irrigation ahead of time in order to have those to achieve their potential yield of their crop, so they don't get the profit that they are planning to get.
And but what about impounding water? Is that a critical thing to do, especially in variable conditions?
Say again.
What about collecting rainwater? Is that critical to do in places that have variable conditions?
So the use of rainwater, we have seen projects investigating of the feasibility of using those rainwater. However, it's not something common here. There are several questions behind the scenes of using those rainwater, because sometimes with the rain, you can carry disease, you can carry insects, any pathogen for your crop. So we don't have that much, because there is available water availability for our growers. It's something completely opposite that what's going on in California, where they have water regulations. And if you look at it in the news, like California is having a whole drought problem right now. Like even their tomatoes crops are dying because of a lack of water. And I don't know if you guys are following the news, but it's apparently the lack of tomatoes because of this problem on weather conditions in California is affecting the production of tomatoes. So all the products derivated from tomatoes, like ketchup, salsa, or those or canned tomatoes, there is some news saying that there will be a raise of cost or an increase in cost of those produce because of that lack of water in California. I do not anticipate such a problem here, but we need to keep our eyes open for those type of problems.
Well, it sounds like collecting rainwater is critical. Again, if you have a summer of drought and you've collected rainwater, you can theoretically water your plants, so it's a more normal season. You know, if you have a year with tons of rain, you can hopefully capture a lot for the next year. Or if there's another state or municipality that needs water, maybe you can truck it to them. I mean, it seems like it should be a nationwide rainwater collection effort. I would think actually in every country in the world, if they can, unless it's unbelievably rainy. Because again, that water could be used to help other people, if not themselves.
Yeah, I said, I have seen this type of research investigating the use of those rainwater. For example, in Florida, they do use a different irrigation system than what we use here. The most common irrigation system for vegetables in Florida is they call seepage irrigation, where water is applied to furrows and raise the water table level. So there was one research that investigated how to reuse those water and also the water that comes from the rain. But the problem is if your field has pathogen and you get that water from the rain and you apply in your next crop, you are moving the pathogen that will cause disease to your next problem, then you're going to have problems. So while that's some environmentally, it sounds perfect using the rainwater, it might drastically affect the production. So that's why you don't see that often.
It sounds like more the storage of rainwater, because otherwise crops are outside, it rains on them all the time, there's no problems. So yeah. Why would there be problems with collecting rainwater? It sounds like in the storage of it, I guess, yeah. Bugs can get in if you don't watch out, pathogens. Like, what are some practices to make sure your stored rainwater doesn't foul?
That would be possible in controlled environmental circumstance, like in a high tunnel. But in an open field where you required a lot of water to the crop, I don't think that we're going to have like a place to store that water. But for a controlled environment, yes, there are options where they can install those water retention place from rain, and then they apply in the crop over time. That's perfect.
Well, even if there's not a lot of water to apply, I mean, if you have like really conservative drip irrigation systems and you have, I don't know, 1,000 gallons of water to water a field, it may be not a lot, but it could be the difference between the field dying and not, if you're able to give it a little bit.
Could be helpful. Yeah, definitely. If you have growers can have that ability, yeah, why not?
So what are some best practices with rainwater collection and storage that you've identified? What have you seen works best?
So I never did any research on reusing rainwater. My focus is more related of when to apply water for the crops, like using different technologies to apply water for the crops. For example, using soil moisture sensors or then estimate how much, or using weather stations to estimate how much water is being updated to the plant, and then just replace how much water is being lost by the soil or how much water is being uptaken by the plants. Those are more the kind of research that I have been doing. Most of our growers, they apply water to their crops in the same way as most of the householders irrigate their lawn. For what I mean is, they just go there on a irrigation panel and they program, I'm going to turn my water every day from 9 to 10, or twice a day from 8 to 8:30, and then later 12 to 12:30, or it's depend on how much water they want to apply, but they basically just program the irrigation and let it go. So when they do that, they are most of the time applying more water than the crop needs on the early stage of crop development, and less water than the crop needs on later stages of crop development. So, and that's stress the plants and reduce their yields. So my focus, my research focus is to identify on management, on they should apply the right amount of water for the plant when the plants need the water the most, and or apply water according to how much water your soil can hold. So this way you will never apply more water than the plants need or less water than the plants need. So my focus.
What are some specifics? Like, should you water plants at night, or is that not good because they're in a, you know, not in a growing stage? Should you water them early morning? Like, what are some things you found depending on the plants and the situation that work better?
So for anybody that's working with vegetables or any other crops, or even with their garden, the best time for water your plants is early in the morning or late in the day. This way you make sure that the water distributes in your soil and the roots of any crop will be able to uptake that water. If you apply water in the middle of the day, your plants might be lacking water early or late, because plants, they don't uptake water during the night. They just uptake water during the day. So during the sun exposure. So very early in the morning and late in the day is the best time for you to apply water for your tomatoes, any of your bell peppers or peppers, or any of your vegetable crops. That's the time that I would strongly recommend a grower to apply water.
But why can't plants absorb water at night? But what are they doing that prevents it?
It's because the water uptake by plants is through transpiration, and transpiration just occurs during the daylight. During the night, plants are not transpirating. So as plants transpirate, the water is uptake by the roots. It moves through the plants, and then it transpires through the leaves. So that's why plants are just uptaking water during the day.
Does it have to happen at the same time as photosynthesis? Is it necessary to assist the process? Is that why?
Exactly. They're in the same time. Photosynthesis required light, trick the photosynthesis. So it's just going to happen during the day. During the night, there is water fluctuation in the plant. There is no photosynthesis, but that's because plants are also because of the respiration.
Okay. So either early in the morning or close to evening. So do you do a split watering schedule? A little bit in the morning, a little bit in the evening. Is that ideal?
That would be the ideal, because you don't want to supply. Good way to think about that, splitting your irrigation is the best thing for you to do, because you don't eat only one time a day, do you? You have your breakfast, you have your lunch, and then you have your dinner. Plants are the same thing. They don't eat only one time a day. They're going to eat along of the day. So you need to spoon feed those plants, and that's the ideal scenario. So if you can apply water in a little bit and then even if possible in the middle of the day, that would be perfect, because then you are spoon feed your plants. And then in the afternoon again. So splitting your irrigation events, that's what we call would be the best approach for any grower or home garden.
How critical are cover crops or mulch, you know, to reduce the soil temperature, to reduce evaporation from the soil?
That is very, very important. So the use of mulching, it can be a plastic mulching or it can be a plant mulching. It's strongly recommended for vegetable crops, because the principle that they have is to minimize water evaporation from the soil surface, reduce weed pressure, but also increase soil temperature. This way, it's going to increase the accelerate plant growth. So the use of mulching has only benefits for your crop. So it's strongly recommended and for any vegetable crops. Most of large-scale growers, they will use plastic mulching. If you are a home garden, I recommend you can use even pine straw that you put around your house. You can put in your garden, or you can use pine bark. That's another example of mulch. So it's strongly recommended to use mulching to prevent water loss from evaporation, weed pressure, and also to increase or accelerate growth of the crop.
Should people put mulch on right in the beginning, or should they wait till plants sprout? Or sprout them somewhere else, then put them in the ground, then mulch? Like, what's the recommendations on mulching?
I would put them as soon as you plant your crop, you should have mulch in there.
Okay. And you said the big growers use plastic mulch. What do they use?
Yeah, they use a plastic mulch. Plastic mulch is a plastic layer that they install in raised beds. So they raise a bed in the soil about 6 inch of height, 6 and 3 feet wide, with a 6 feet center to center from each bed. And on this raised bed, they put a plastic mulch, and that plastic mulch has the same principle as any other mulching, but it's to increase the temperatures of the soil, to increase plant growth, minimize water evaporation, and reduce weeds. So the large scale production will be in plastic mulch.
Yeah, but I would think on the underside of plastic, you know, tarps, first of all, it's an anaerobic environment. So the bacteria would change, I would think, a lot. I don't know if it would survive the normal ones. And then I would think as it gets hot, you would get water evaporating onto the underside of the plastic and then condensing and dripping back down into the soil, you know, taking some of the plastic, you know, compounds and bringing them into the soil. So I would think plastic, you know, even though it's efficient, might be a really bad type of mulch.
It would be more efficient, you mean? The water,
I think it'll be efficient, but I think it might. I mean, what, you know, what about, again, like creating an anaerobic environment with no oxygen on the soil, and then again condensation and reapplying of water that would have evaporated. What happens to plant beds with plastic covers instead of like wood chips? Let's say.
Yeah, no, it's not like that. It's like the plants. There will be aeration in the soil because. You should not think that plastic will hold also oxygen. It will not be like that. The soil, they can hold water and they can also hold air there because there are the micro and micro pores of the soil. So the plastic is just to increase temperature, literally it's just to increase temperature and avoid that evaporation of the directly contact of the sun with the soil to increase evaporation. But at the same time, because it's holding like the heat there, it's going to increase the temperature under the plastic. So the growers, they will not put it in between beds. They will just put it in the beds. So that's the reason why I said they have a raised bed 3 feet wide, but from center to center, 6 feet. So it's 3 feet of a bed. I skip off 3 feet, another 3 feet. So that's why they do that. So in that, in between that, you still have the dirt with exposure to the sun.
What about where you water? Oh, when you water plants, should you water it right near the stem, or do you water it away from the stem to encourage the roots to go outwards and seek the water by watering maybe a couple inches away from the stem, or should you water right onto the stem?
That's a very good question. Anybody growing a plant, it can be a home garden on a pot or in a large scale. What they need to understand is plants, they don't grow to look for water. They grow where there is water. So the water application should be in the soil close to the plant. That's where you're going to have the bulk of your root zone. So when you are applying your water, you don't need to throw the water in your leaves. You need to throw the water in the soil, close to your stem, not far from the stem. Because if you don't have water where the roots are, they will not reach where you are applying. Plants just grow where there is water. So my recommendation is apply water close to the plant and let they really spread. This way they will spread their...
Wait a minute, why would that be? I mean, I've seen some plants that have really deep extensive roots and some that don't. I would think that the roots can sense and seek water. So wouldn't you want to make the, you know, like if you water maybe a little bit further away from the plant, like let's say you water every day and every other day you water away from the stem and then the other days you water at the stem. Maybe that would encourage the roots to go out further because they see that there's water out further sometimes.
It's the plants will not go further because they are looking for the water where you applied in the day before. They will grow because you applied in the next day water where they are. So that's why. So it doesn't mean that they are looking for that water. Let's say if you have a plant, and then you apply water 10 inches far from that plant and you don't apply where the plant is, the plant will not grow roots to find that one. But if you go in the next day and apply water where the plant is, roots will grow and consequently it will reach that 10 inches. So plants will never lose. They don't have any hormone or any, there is no chemistry on the plants to look for water. Like there are chemistry on the plants or hormones for plants to look for the sunlight, but there is no for looking for water. So plants will just grow roots where there is water. So if you apply water every day at 10 inches far from the, like from a transplant or from a seed, your plant will not grow as good as the one that you plant on top of where you irrigate every day. They can grow because there will be some water there available, but it will not be as good as you apply water every day on your plant.
So what would make a plant have a deeper root system than another plant? Like why would they, what would tell the roots to spread out and how far and where to go?
Because you are probably overwatering and then you have more water than your plant need, and that plant will continue to grow their root system as deeper as you apply water. Because as you apply water, water will not stay in the top of your soil. It's going to move deeper with gravity because water will always move laterally initially and then deeper in the soil. So you apply water there today, more than it needs. So water will infiltrate. Then you apply water again, and that's will infiltrate. That water that it's below the root system will not be a uptake. So the roots will just continually grow until you reach that water because you are applying more water, 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 and water. So that's what you need to keep in mind. They are not growing there because they're looking for more water, but because you applied water there and they will continue growing their roots.
Oh, okay. Are there strategies, are there watering strategies to try to maximize the size of the root bundle? What are some of your watering strategies?
Okay.
What do they do?
That's because most of the vegetables, they are annual crops, so you plant them every year. Their root system will be kept at max at 12 inches of the soil. So after harvest, you remove the plants and you plant a new crop. So for us, the root growth is in the early stages of the crop development. So early in the season, you don't need much water, but you can apply water enough for the plants to develop that bulk root system on about 6 inches, and that's going to anchor the plants. Then you're going to have the secondary roots come out, and that's when you're going to have those roots going everywhere. They will fall, they will be everywhere because there is some moisture in the soil regardless. But the plants that will be uptaking most of the water are the one in that 6 inches of that. So your strategy is to, again, we come back for the spoon feeding. Spoon feed your crops with water, so they will be always growing their roots. Of course, you cannot forget nutrients. You need nutrients for the plants to grow. So a good application of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, which are macronutrients, is essential for you to ensure your root growth, but also your yield. Consequently, will be your yield.
So again, what are some innovative watering strategies that you've come up with? You know, what situation required a different kind of watering strategy? Any examples?
I know you mean, yes. So the use of soil moisture sensors is the top-notch irrigation scheduling. Your question is, what are the irrigation scheduling available? So soil moisture sensors are the top-notch approach or methods of irrigation scheduling, where you're going to install sensors in the soil, and those sensors read the moisture in your soil. So when the moisture reaches a particular level, you turn your irrigation on to supply what was lost. So initially, when your plants are still small, you want to irrigate only at 6 inches of that. But as your plant grow, the roots will always also grow. So then you can start to irrigate at 12 inches of depth. I'm talking about vegetables, but if you go for row crops, you might gonna irrigate based on a different depth of the soil. So that is gonna be your top-notch use right now, soil moisture sensor. Another approach could be to use some what we call crop evapotranspiration. This method, it's apply water based on how much water is being uptake by the plant daily. And that's going to depend on your weather conditions. So you're going to require to have access to a weather station data or have a weather station on your place. That's going to be like you're going to calculate how much water was lost by evaporation if you don't have a plastic mulch, or and plus by how much water is lost by your crop. So this way, you know how much water to apply in the following day. That can be water can be applied every day based on the evapotranspiration on the day before, or it can be applied every 2 days based on the sum of the evapotranspiration on the past 2 days, or it can be even weekly. You calculate how much water was lost in the last week per day, and then you apply in this week per day. So those are the top two. After that, you're going to come for what the growers are doing, which is the one that we are not recommending anymore in our extension system. It's because the grower will apply water with a panel, and this water application will be based on the the same volume every day or a same period of time every day. And we call it a systematic irrigation scheduling.
Okay. Again, are there any special or different ways to water to produce different effects? Like, do certain plants need a to dry out more than others? Others need maybe more continuous watering and never fall below a certain moisture level. Or plants that go into the from the vegetative stage to the flowering stage, how do their water needs change?
Okay. Yeah. So during during the vegetative stage, plants will increase their water demand. Still, water stress, like if there's a lack of water, it will affect their growth, but which consequently will affect yield. But if you cause a lack of water during flowering, the flowering period is the point that you're going to start to impact your yield. So you don't want your plants to lack water during flowering period. So for your question, yes, don't stress your plants during flowering and fruiting. Otherwise, you're going to have a reduction in yield. Those are the timing. And this is, I'm talking about vegetables. So it's regardless of vegetable crops, you don't want to cause any stress. I can give you a good example. Most of people think that watermelons, before harvesting, they quit irrigating watermelon, the fruit for about a week or two, because they think that the fruit will get sweeter when you quit irrigation. And that's not true, because the sweetness of the fruit is a consequence of the nutrients uptake by the plants. Nutrients are uptake by the water. So if you cut the irrigation 2 weeks before harvesting, you are consequently cutting the way how plants uptake their nutrients that will be converted in sugar. So the fruit will not get sweeter if you cut the irrigation. Actually, it's the opposite. If you keep irrigating, then they will get sweeter. So that's a good example for why you should keep your irrigation during flowering and fruiting. So you're going to get a better fruit or a better vegetable.
Okay. What are some projects that you're working on right now? What are you studying and what questions are you trying to answer in your research?
Yeah. So now one of the ones that we are working on is exactly this one that I mentioned about the watermelon. We are evaluating the three different methods of irrigation scheduling for watermelon. Also for tomato production, we are evaluating those irrigation scheduling. Some of our project is to understand the challenge of transition from conventional to organic production. We have opened an organic farm in one of our research stations here in Auburn at Auburn University, where we are documenting what are the most common weeds for a grower installing an organic farm and how to control those weeds. Same thing for what are the most common insects or the most common disease that a tomato crop will have. And then we are documenting that. And then we are looking for what are the practices, the crop management practices that those organic growers should have. Remember that organic is not something that you're going to get from the day to the night, from the night to the day. It's take 3 years for a grower to get a USDA organic certification. And so we are in the third year of our transitioning right now. And we are coming with best management practices to help growers to minimize the damage caused during the transition. Because when you have the transition, there is a lot of organic farming is a challenge when compared to conventional farming.
Oh, what are some of the challenges that you've seen? What makes it so difficult to transition?
In Alabama, by far, the largest challenge is the weed control, because we are in an environment where we are in a subtropical environmental conditions where the weeds will grow all year around. So you're going to have summer weeds, we're going to have winter weeds, and those weeds, they reproduce much faster than our crops. So just for you to know, like on weeds, they can like, there are some weeds that can produce like 1 million seeds every 3 weeks. So then those weeds will start to sprout in our environment. Then you're going to have that competition for nutrients and water in the soil. So what we are identifying is that if you properly manage your cover crop during the off season of your main crop, you can suppress that weed population. So since you can only spray organic herbicides on organic production, even during the transitioning, the control of those weeds become a challenge. So that would be our largest challenge for the growers. Another thing is the disease and insects, but then those you can control with starting with a proper cultivar selection. So if you select a cultivar that is resistant to a particular disease that you have in your region, that is going to be like the first step of a proper IPM, which is an integrated pest management. So those are the kind of research that we are doing and we recommend. So for weeds, for those who are trying to grow their own crops organically, using a cover crop is going to be the first step for transitioning from conventional to organic.
Do cover crops only get planted in the off season, or are there deliberate cover crops you can plant that act like mulch that live right near the regular plants you want?
So the term of a cover crop is yes, when you plant it on off season. However, so if you plant it during the season, you don't want that cover crop to become a weed, because the definition of weed is any undesirable plant on your field. So a cover crop can become a weed. So you can plant cover crop during your regular season, but you need to make sure that it doesn't become a competitor of nutrients with your cash crop. So what we are investigating right now, and I cannot tell you because we don't have the results yet, but if it's going to work or not, it's what if we just remove the cover crop from our beds, from where we are planting our crop, instead to remove everything and then plant our crop? Or what if we don't incorporate that cover crop in the soil and we plant on top of, or we just chop our cover crop and then plant on top of that cover crop, and that biomass accumulated by the cover crop will become our mulching? So those are the kind of investigation that we are currently doing in our organic farm. So for answering your question, if like, can we plant a cover crop during the season? Yes, you can. Just make sure that you are not, this cover crop is not competing with your cash crop.
Are there companion crops then that maybe you're not going to eat, but they help the stuff that you're growing, the main, you know, like potatoes? Are there any companion crops that help them grow, or is it only ones that get in their way?
No, they are companion crops. We have seen growers doing that. Companion crops means that you are growing two cash crops at the same time. A good example of companion crops that growers use is it's growing cotton, and then in the end of the season, and then cotton and cantaloupes. So you plant cantaloupes that have a fast growth early in the season, And then when the cantaloupes are about to be harvested, you come with your cotton. So they are, although they are competing from the same nutrients, you are generating fun, you're making profit from both crops. So if you want to do companion crops for growers, it would be like cotton and cantaloupe. Something that I have seen before, I never investigate any like how to do that, but I have seen growers doing that, is strawberry and onions. So you plant two rows of strawberry, and in between those rows of strawberries, you plant an onion row. So you can optimize the area. So there are options for you to do companion crop. You just need to properly select. And those two are the one that I have seen the success. Cotton and cantaloupe and onion and strawberry and onion.
Why do you think they work together and other mixes don't? Like what happens if you get a mix that's not good? Do they stunt the growth of both or what happens?
Yes, then first they will start competing from the nutrients. They can grow above, one crop can grow above the other one and cause it shading. Then the one shaded will not grow properly, will impact your yield. So that's going to be the main points, like the competition for water, nutrients, and shading, one shading the other.
Okay, well, very good. Well, Andre, any other main questions that you're pursuing that you're trying to figure out? And then, we'll wrap up with how to contact you.
Yeah. So, yeah, I would say that irrigation scheduling and fertility is the first step that any grower should be doing for the success of their crop. It can be conventional or organic, because if a crop is not healthy, if they're not eating well, they will have problems with insect and disease later. So my point is make sure that you do so my research and my questions as a researcher is to identify how can we optimize that production by properly irrigating and applying fertilizer on the crop. And we have found a good results. Growers are starting to adapt our recommendations. And as far as my contact, if anybody would like to get in touch and we can follow with assistant, they can search for our website at the university or also at the Alabama Cooperative Extension System where we are part. And but they can call me can I say my cell phone?
If you like, or probably email is best. That would work best. Yeah.
Email at adasilva@auburn.edu. So, and I will be more than happy to follow and help them to prepare their land or give recommendations on what to apply, when to plant, or how to irrigate or fertilizer their crop.
Very good. Well, Andre, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure to be here, and anytime you need.
Before you stop listening, ask yourself, what are one or two useful things you heard on this podcast that can help you overcome food and fertilizer shortages, skyrocketing prices, the cost of living, or your job being outsourced overseas or eliminated due to automation? Please like and subscribe and tell your friends and family about their Surviving Hard Times podcast. We're all going to need help now and in the near future.